So I think that we should proceed now and get right into our discussion with Seshagiri Rao on the theme of service and Hinduism today.
Well, since we're going to be talking about Hinduism, let me just ask Seshagiri to tell us briefly about a project that he brought to fruition, the brand newly launched Encyclopedia of Hinduism, recently launched in India at a ceremony that was hosted by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Seshagiri, can you just tell us a little bit about it?
The host was, of course, Swami Chidananda Muniji, and the person who was invited was Dalai Lama, and His Holiness Dalai Lama released the first three volumes of the encyclopedia.
And tell us a little bit more about the work itself. I know it's enormous.
It is
bringing together so many scholars.
Yes, hundreds of scholars from all over the world, United States, England, and lots of scholars from India and Europe participated, and it is it has more than 7,500 entries, and it has a number of volumes, and now it will be released in the West also. All the 11 volumes, the total volumes are 11, and it will be helpful not only to the persons interested in Hindu tradition and world religions, but it will also be helpful to the academicians and scholars who wants to know more about the tradition. And many of some of the misinterpretations and misunderstandings about Hinduism have been put straight. They have been set right in the encyclopedia.
Well, you're to be congratulated. I know something about the work that was involved, and it was enormous. It's an incredible accomplishment. Now, Seshagiri, if you were sitting down for the first time with a person from another religious tradition or no religious background at all, someone who knew really not much at all about Hinduism or the religions of India, what would you tell them about your tradition?
First of all, I would say it is the most ancient tradition, if not the only ancient tradition. It is called Sanatana Dharma. It is, we know that 7,000 years ago we had Indus Valley civilization beginning and all that kind of thing. So it is not only ancient, but it is also very modern and up to date, because it goes on. All religions are dynamic, and then they go on adjusting to the changed circumstances. While the core values, the eternal values, are the same, but they are to be adjusted to the situations and the conditions of the time, society, and etc. And this Hinduism has been doing, and therefore it is both ancient and also contemporary.
And you think the Hindu tradition has been particularly effective in staying current and yet staying faithful to its ancient roots?
That is so. In fact, it has been able to say, for example, you have heard about the caste system and the position of women and so on, scheduled caste and so on. And take the example of Mahatma Gandhi. He addressed all those issues, and then in a similar way, many people before him also addressed. So they are, whatever is not up to date and relevant to the present condition of society, they are changing. That is what is important. Whatever is not relevant, it should be changed. Whatever is helpful to the whole humanity, it has to be kept.
And the term, can you help our listeners understand the Sanskrit term you just used, Sanatana Dharma?
Sanatana means it's very ancient. Sanatana means ancient. In fact, it is eternal. They say it's Sanatana because truth does not have a beginning or an end. It is always there. It is eternal. In that sense, Hinduism is Sanatana. It has no beginning.
So, And Sanatana Dharma for teaching or truth?
Dharma is not only the teaching of truth, but teaching of the application of truth in life. That is Dharma.
Very nice.
That's a very interesting. May I ask a question too?
Please.
Just to go back a moment. We know that Hinduism, one of the very interesting things for a Western person is that the notion of the sacred or of God or of the transcendent or divine is not the same as in the monotheistic tradition. And we wondered if you could talk a little bit about the notion of the divine as it is viewed by Hinduism.
Very good.
Well, in the Hindu tradition, the most important thing is truth. Truth is that which exists. Truth exists in you. Truth exists in everybody. Truth exists outside you. Truth exists inside you. And what is the nature of this truth? That is to understand. So there is nothing is important if it does not contain truth. Truth is the only important thing. It is truth that makes everything valuable. So that truth is called God. It has two phases, as it were. The nirguna, that means that which doesn't have qualities, and saguna, that which has qualities and attributes. When you have the qualities and attributes, it becomes personal. But truth is not only personal, it is also impersonal. It is both law and the lawgiver. Lawgiver is the supreme being, that is the monotheistic God, and law is the one that is not to be forgotten. That is like a gravitation or nuclear energy and all those things, they follow certain laws. These laws are important. So we have to be careful about both the aspects of the truth. And the West usually has the monotheistic aspect or the personal aspect, but Hinduism gives importance to both the aspects.
Mm. That's very important for us because it's so holistic in its way
yes.
of being. Jim?
One of the materials that we've provided for people to prepare for these calls is a sheet with very brief statements about the excellence of each religion. We've repeated several times the remarkable teaching by a scholar I know you're aware of, Fritjof Schuon, a great Swiss scholar who wrote many years ago that every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. So we've tried to identify some of the excellences of the different traditions. And I just want you to consider this. For Hinduism, we offered Hinduism as the richest expression of the infinite divine, one God with countless faces, emphases, and dimensions. Many paths come together here, from blissful meditation to lifelong study, to devotion to God, to selfless service, and then a line that you and I have often discussed, truth is one, but the sages know it by many names. How does that sound to you as a sort of distillation of the excellence of Hinduism?
I just would like to add one more thing to what you have said in a very nice way. It is not the belief, it is not the knowledge that is important, it is the practice that is important. This is the importance that is given. It is dharma. That means if you know about things, say, for example, you know about lots of things about swimming, but if you don't get into the water, you don't know how to swim. So knowledge is not enough, but actually practice is most important. That is what emphasized in the Hindu tradition. In fact, 1 ounce of practice is better than 1 ton of theoretical knowledge.
Theoretical knowledge. That is absolutely priceless, that kind of insight, don't you think?
And it fits so well with the next thing we wanted to talk about. Today's theme is service, or seva in Sanskrit. And in religious life and in our day-to-day experience, what's so important about it? I think you've already given us the opening to this response, but what's so important about the notion of service historically in India, but also today as we think about living in this complex world?
Well, as I mentioned, putting truth in action, that is what is important. How do you put truth into action? How do you put love in action? How do you put compassion in action? It is by serving other people. In fact, one of the statements in the Hindu tradition says, Jana Seva is Janardana Seva. Janardana is the Supreme Being, God. Jana is the people. The service to people is service to God. And Gandhi calls this as Sarvodaya. Sarvodaya means the development and welfare of all. And it is so important to analyze that particular statement and also that particular phrase, Sarvodaya. Sarva means all, Udaya means development or welfare, but it has two important connotations. On the one hand, no discrimination between race, religion, nation, and all the other things, sex. Every person is equal. Every person, you can serve all people. You must serve all people. On the other hand, sarva also means all aspects of being. Sarvodaya means you have the physical aspect, mental aspect, the biological aspect, the intellectual aspect, and spiritual aspect. These are all the various dimensions of your personality. What has happened very often in many countries and among many people, they only give importance to the physical aspect. That becomes like consumerism. That becomes like working only for materialism and all that kind of thing. So you have to understand the nature of the person, the personality. And if you forget these things, if you forget, for example, that you are a spiritual being, you have a spiritual dimension, then you forget about what is it that you want to achieve in life, what is your goal of life. You only talk about the physical aspect, then you are only talking about eating and drinking and sleeping, things like that. But if you are a spiritual being, then your ideals and goals are different. So you have to understand yourself and you have to understand the society. And when you speak about... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so my service to the other and to humankind is not only at the physical level or the material level, but at the spiritual level as well.
In fact, that is more important. They have to be given not only the proper knowledge and the proper way to put that knowledge into practice. That is service.
That's a very interesting interpretation of service, because even with our best intentions, many of us think about service kind of in the way of altruism, where if we can help to feed or clothe or help in time of a disaster, for example, that we're being of service to other people. But this adds a much, much richer dimension, that it is also our responsibility to be of service in terms of doing what we can to help others have a way of viewing the world in a spiritual or mindful way that might be of comfort and assistance to them. Is that what you're talking about?
I remember a story about Alexander when he went to India and conquered so many places, and then he was told about a seer or a sage in a particular place. And in order to please Aristotle, he wanted to meet him and then, if possible, to take him to Greece. And he went to this person. Then he said, come with me and I will give you all the things you want. That sage says, I don't want anything. I am happy. I am completely happy. If you don't come, then I am going to hurt you. You can hurt the body. You are not going to hurt me. Do whatever you want. So a person who is happy, a person who is who has realized the nature of his self, he doesn't care for the rest of the things. But who has not realized, in the case of ordinary people, we have to serve, first of all, the members of our family and the members of our locality, community, the members of our village, the members of the nation, the country, and the world this way. So service is not limited to one group. It has to extend to include all groups.
Well, this is connected to the next area we wanted to touch on, which is the whole business of interfaith or interreligious encounter and dialogue and understanding. You've been involved in that for most of your life. You've been involved in the parliaments of the world's religions. You've been very active in the World Congress of Faith, centered in the United Kingdom. Work on the journal that I also serve, Interreligious Insight. Tell us why you think all of this is important. Why is that connection between and among the world's religious and spiritual traditions? First of all, why is it important? Second, perhaps, how do we best go about it? And third, do you think we're getting better at it? Is this a sign of what I would call cultural evolution? So, three questions. Why is it important? How do we go about it, and how are we doing?
First of all, it is sure that interreligious movement is gaining momentum around the world. It points not only to the necessity of dialogue between religious followers of different faiths, but also the desirability of their involvement in the promotion of human values at practical levels. In particular, there is the need for worldwide coordination of religious leadership as a driving force for fostering peace, for encouraging mutual understanding and respect, as well as for working cooperatively for constructive human goals. The other point is that universal values cut across all religions, civilizations, and cultures. They are human values. We all belong to the family of humankind. No civilization is an island to itself. Dialogue enables us to reclaim our common humanity and intrinsic spirituality. It helps us to accentuate the positive insights of all religions and cultures and to transcend the negative elements. All religions can contribute to the celebration of life. Freedom is universally valid. Pursuit of moral and spiritual values is the essential part of civilization. Respect for human rights, search for unity in diversity, sanctity of life, non-violence and love, and the search for truth are highly regarded by all. They have to be nurtured and used for shaping the future of human civilization. And this is what interreligious movement is trying to do.
Since we're talking about other religions, can you say a word or two about two of the other great traditions of India that I know you know well, the Jain tradition and the Sikh tradition? We'll be talking about Buddhism next week here on the program, but can you say a word or two about Jainism and Sikhism for people not so familiar with them?
First of all, Sikhism started a little over 500 years ago by Guru Nanak. He was faced with the kind of trouble and conflicts that were going on between Hinduism and Islam. And he had a very ecumenical approach to things, and he tried to bring these two religions together. And the Sikh tradition is very ecumenical. It applies to every religious tradition. That means it wants to learn about the values and the insights in every religious tradition, and it respects all the religions. And we find this. And also, it tried to undo certain things. For example, It doesn't believe in caste system. It doesn't believe in the secondary status of women and all those things. So the best of the values, and very ecumenical in nature. Whatever was best in Islam, he took. Whatever was best in Hinduism, he took. But it was all his realization that was important, and that is what gave rise to Sikh tradition. Jainism is very, very old religion. In fact, as old as Hinduism itself, if not more. It has 24 most important teachers. They are called Tirthankaras. It is very ecumenical. It accepts all the religious traditions. And one of the theories in their tradition is called Syadvada. Syadvada means, yes, this is a possible, this is possible, this is possible. The only difference is points of view. You might have several photographs of a mountain, let us say, from different points of view. But each photograph is correct because from that point of view, that is correct. From this point of view, this view is correct. So unless you put yourself in that position, you won't be able to appreciate it. That's why you have to give importance to every tradition and see every tradition in the way in which the tradition, people who follow the tradition see it. That is the importance of Jainism.
Wow, that sounds so reasonable and so sane that you wonder why all religions might not feel that way. And my question to add on to Jim's question would be, do you think that it's this ability to see the truth of what is possible and acceptable from so many different points of view in some way gives rise to the very important concept in Jainism of ahimsa, the very deep nonviolence that is practiced?
Yes. First of all, truth and life, they are together. Truth and life, they are one. And since life is truth, you can't cut off any part of the truth, any part of that life. That's why nonviolence is necessary. In order to understand the wholeness of the truth, we have to have nonviolence. Only through nonviolence you can understand the truth. Only through love you can understand truth.
I think the more we learn about the religions of India, you've talked to, about Hinduism and then Jainism and Sikhism, and we'll talk more about Buddhism next time. That the openness to the truth in other traditions really seems to be a big part of India's gift to the world, especially at a time when there's so much religious exclusivism. You know, the idea that the truth of my religion demands that yours be false. There's so much of that around, especially in the current American scene. It's really refreshing to hear that Indian openness to the truth that the other knows.
That is a very important word that you have used, openness. Are you open to the currents of truth that are coming from different sources? If you are open, then you are free. If you are not open, then you don't understand. And you are not free. You have exclusivism means that I have the truth and nobody else has the truth. That means you are not able to appreciate and understand the truth that is present in different traditions.
This is very consistent with some of the research going on at the cutting edge of some of our scientific traditions these days, that there is so much truth. The truth is so vast that if you don't keep open as a system, you can't possibly absorb the very, I would say, the variety of ways in which truth can present itself, whether it's in the scientific world or the religious world or any other way of being. That's so very important for us to remember.
You have brought up a very important topic about science and about spirituality or spiritual approach to truth. Scientific approach to truth is quantitative. Scientific approach to truth is limited to the empirical world. It is limited to what you can see and what you can hear and what you can taste and things like that. It's all empirical. But then, science does not tell you about love. Science does not tell you about the goals of life, the meaning of love. It doesn't tell you how you should live and what you should live for and all those things. So that's why very important aspects of your life are not covered by science. The holistic approach is very important because there is more. In fact, I liked the way you put it. The truth is so vast. And in order to go to truth, first of all, you have to be prepared to see truth wherever it is. So the transcendental truth, the truth inside you, not just outside you. That's important. That's spiritual truth. So, scientific truth, well and good. Science and technology are helpful. They are helpful to make your life more comfortable, standards of living increase. That's fine. But then, what is it that you want? What is it that makes you happy? You want to just earn more and more money? Ask people who have lots of money. Millions of dollars if they are happy. Some of them have millions, but then they are in jail already. So,
well,
what I'm trying to say is money does not make you happy. House does not make you happy. All these things are only conditions. But the happiness is in you. Try to realize yourself, understand the nature of happiness, then you will be happy.
So the best security and defense system on the planet is happiness and liberation.
Happiness and freedom. You are absolutely correct. Openness.
Well, that's something that our government should take seriously.
Yeah. Openness doesn't actually rules out any kind of dogmatism, any kind of exclusivism. This is the whole definition of truth. In fact, even to define truth is to limit truth. Don't define truth. You realize truth.
Absolutely.
You know, whenever I have this conversation about the notion of exclusivism in religion, I'm reminded of the fact that religions necessarily express themselves in the most delicate, symbolic, metaphorical, expressive language. It's closer to artistic language than to scientific language. And yet, if someone were to suggest that we ought to take a fundamentalist approach to art and try to decide which form of artistic expression is the true and rule out all the others, decide that sculpture has it and dance does not, we'd all think that a ridiculous sort of enterprise. And yet we make the same mistake when we try to approach religion in a fundamentalist or exclusivistic way. So I really appreciate what Seshagiri's had to say here. Well, I just want to thank Seshagiri for being with us here today. And I've heard you speak before about the essential worth of the human being and about becoming fully human. What is it that, as we break up here, what is it that makes us human beings unique and that challenges us especially? What do you want to say about that?
I want to say that the search for truth through life is a very important thing. And the search for truth should be done without any conditions. That means we don't have to put a stop to it. We don't have to regulate it in a particular way and not in the other way. And we also should try to find out spiritual values which are universal. All that is great and good in world religions are to be highlighted and pressed for the service of humanity. noble insights of different faith traditions should make life and society more human and humane. The religious leaders of the world have a responsibility to promote good life for all by creating appropriate structures to fight evil and injustice non-violently in individual and social realms. Our age demands a new spiritual vision and a new socio-economic order for the development and betterment of all peoples all over the world.